listening to Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM Winnipeg. And I'm joined again by Sarah. Hi, Sarah. Thanks so much for recording with me today.
Thanks for having me in my own apartment.
Yeah. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze foreign science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and women and gender studies. Our knowledge and experience will hopefully provide you with access points to feminist theory, art history, and film critique while using horror and science fiction genres as a site of discourse. Since we will be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, especially with this movie, content warning, listener discretion is advised, also spoilers ahead. This week, we are discussing Meyer Zarchi's 1978 film, I Spit on Your Grave.
Take off your clothes.
I don't like women giving me orders.
I spit on your grave. What you are about to see did happen. I spit on your grave. This woman will soon cut, chop, break, and burn five men beyond recognition. And there isn't a jury in this country that will convict her.
I scared you, didn't I?
What do you want?
It's you I want.
Gang-raped, humiliated, and left for dead by four men who she systematically hunts down to seek revenge. Sarah, what is your history with I Spit on Your Grave?
Well, I watched the 2010 remake that's on Netflix for some reason, and had all sorts of feelings about it, and yeah. We were talking, and you mentioned the original, and that we could chat about it here, so I watched it last week, and I kind of wish that I hadn't seen the remake at all, because it's hard for me not to draw comparisons.
Right.
I think that the original is much better in ways that seem important, given the subject matter of this film. The way that it's shot, it's sort of like in a voyeuristic way at first, like with the opening scene of her coming out of her apartment, and the way the camera sort of seems to be looking around and then like lands on her is really good. The pacing and the attention given to the whole story, not just the rape part, felt thoughtful and deliberate, which, I mean, not to compare, I think that that was something that was really less awesome in remake. So yeah, but up until I accidentally watched it on Netflix, I hadn't really, I'd seen it and was like, oh, this sounds gross.
Yeah.
What about you?
This is my first time seeing this movie after you suggested it, or after we were talking about it a few weeks ago. It's obviously very upsetting, but I was surprised by how beautiful the film looks and how quiet it is. There's just no music at all throughout.
Yeah.
The way rape culture manifests is also really subtle initially, like how the men are shown objectifying, then catcalling and harassing, then finally attacking Jennifer. And one of the most frightening scenes for me was when Jennifer is alone in the house and hears strange noises from outside. It's just an interesting portrayal of the initiation into patriarchy and the ritual of male violence. Meyer Zarchi apparently made the film after discovering a survivor of a brutal sexual assault. So it's interesting to think of this film as like a way for the filmmaker to work through his trauma after seeing such, after witnessing such violence.
That is interesting. It's also called The Day of the Woman, right?
Initially,
the original initial title of it, which sort of, I don't think is like off base in this. It's not like, you know, some movies are like, well, that was not the right title at all. Like, I think for this, it's pretty fitting.
Yeah, I agree. And I feel that the viewer is always on Jennifer's side which within some exploitation films it can get a little murky, but it is cool that Jennifer is always the main protagonist and we're always supposed to be on her side.
And there's like no doubt about that. I totally agree. There's no doubt.
So I just want to start with talking about exploitation film generally. So an exploitation film is a film that attempts to succeed financially by exploiting current trends, niche genres, or lurid content. Exploitation films are generally low-quality B-movies. They sometimes attract critical attention and cult followings. Some of the films, such as Night of the Living Dead, which we talked about a few weeks ago, set trends and become historically important. Exploitation films may feature suggestive or explicit sex, sensational violence, drug use, nudity, gore, the bizarre, destruction, rebellion, and mayhem. Such films were first seen in their modern form in the early 1920s, but they were popularized in the 1960s and 70s with general relaxing of censorship and cinematic taboos in the U.S. and Europe. Subgenres include blaxploitation films like Shaft and Blackula, Nazi exploitation, monster, giallo, and cannibal movies like Cannibal Holocaust. And one subgenre, which is kind of, I think, portrayed in this film, is redneck horror or hillbilly horror. So created with early movies such as Deliverance from 1972, this unofficial subgenre plays on the myth that backwoods and remote countryside are populated with inbred freaks and maniacs. The subgenre, which became famous with the success of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Hills Have Eyes, often features families and clans of crazies and often the threat of cannibalism. Redneck horror can reflect social anxiety surrounding class and the rural other, much like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the sort of like fantasy of the American dream. And they do, the way that Jennifer is framed, like as the way that her rapist and the men in the film talk about her is that she's like this fancy city girl.
City girl, that comes up a lot.
Yeah.
And it is like, there's the very, you know, it's like, it's the film starts with her leaving her New York or wherever apartment, mm-hmm. like doorman and all, getting into a cab, like car, checking her, putting her bags in the trunk and everything. And then like making her way out to this cabin in the woods, basically. Mm-hmm. That there is that very much of like the us and them mm-hmm. aspect of it, but she's not unfriendly or whatever. She's just like excited. She's like, oh, I'm going to go right. This is great.
Yeah.
And they seem to be like, oh, a city girl. Yeah.
So just to continue on, like talk about exploitation films. So rape revenge films are a subgenre of exploitation film that rose to prominence in the 1970s and were immediately met with controversy. Their brutal portrayals of sexual violence earned them the title Video Nasties by the British Board of Film Censors in 1984. They were too explicit to be sold in stores because they were quote, glorified the act of rape and inspired copycat crimes. Films such as I Spit on Your Grave, Miss 45, and The Last House on the Left earned cult followings and horrified large audiences. And rape revenge films generally follow the same three-act structure. So Act 1, a usually female character is violently raped and further abused, tortured, or left for dead. Act 2, the character survives and may rehabilitate themselves. Act 3, the character exacts revenge and or kills their rapist. In some cases, the character is incapacitated or killed at the end of the first act, and the revenge is carried out by their family or friends, as in I Saw the Devil, Last House on the Left, and Jennifer's Body. And rape revenge is one of those is a genre which holds like several contradictions at once. Because on one hand, you can sort of see it as like this power fantasy because she does get to kill all her rapists at the end of it. It gives a face to predators and threat of sexual violence. It also makes a taboo issue visible. I know I've talked about this book a lot, but Dead Blondes and Bad Mothers by Sadie Doyle, she sort of compares it, like being a fan of horror in general, it can be compared to true crime fandoms, such as like My Favorite Murder, Law & Order SVU. Like, why wouldn't we be obsessed with figuring out sexualized violence, right?
Yeah, like, we all have, you know, like, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and like, finding a good true crime one is like, when you do, it's like, oh my god, this is amazing, right. I just want to like binge it, and it is always like, some terrible thing happened to some like, innocent person, and it's just like, let's find all the details, so it does like, this does, like, the podcast, the, like, every, like, this movie, all of these things do play to our sort of, like, voyeuristic, like, worst-case scenario intrigue and stuff.
Yeah. I just have a quote here from Sadie Doyle. She's just talking about slasher movies, generally. So, slasher movies are a release in part because they give a name and a face to the problem. They transform our culture's underlying sexual violence into spectacle and story, giving us monsters to fear and heroines to root for. They perfect all low-level anxiety into a quick, bright, bloody burst of fear. Which I agree with as a horror fan, I feel like. I don't know. Yeah, it does. Yeah, it gives a face to see these sort of underlying fears. And, yeah, I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is, like, that's all the, you know, the facing the things that scare you. And,
yeah.
I mean, like, things that I like about horror, I love gore. Like, the gorier, the better, mm-hmm. the most ridiculous kind of thing. But when it is the horror of, like, the, like, stalking or the things that are, like, potentially real,
mm-hmm.
I get, like, a little less into that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think even, like, with horror, there's the aspect of, like, escapism.
Right.
And, like, wanting that to be a part of the experience. Like, you know, like, I will watch probably, like, literally anything. Like any trash, anything.
Mm-hmm.
Just to be like, wow, I didn't have to think for a little bit.
Yeah.
But when you're, like, in this situation, when you're watching a movie about, like, a violent gang rape, you're like, oh, okay, this
yeah.
is not, and, like, this is not allowing me to escape any kind of reality.
Exactly.
Like, this is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, but I do think that it does name things and show things and potentially provides an opportunity to talk about and to deal with in some capacity. Like, really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I have another quote here from an article from The Guardian by Ann Bilson, how the rape revenge movie became a feminist weapon for the Me Too generation. So they write, on the one hand, what could be more empowering than watching a woman wreaking violent vengeance on her abusers? I'm not aware of this being something that happens in real life, but what's wrong with a little fantasy wish fulfillment? Unlike Me Too accusers who have to go through the courts, yet another ordeal, or make do with naming and shaming, the rape revenge protagonist can let rip with Old Testament vengeance. But the rape revenge movie is a game of two unequal halves. The thrill of vicarious empowerment is backloaded into the later part of the movie, while the earlier instigating sexual violence is often teased out in harrowing detail, unbearably grueling to watch, or worse, filmed salaciously. And I don't necessarily feel like I Spit on Your Grave was filmed salaciously. I think it's pretty brutal and horrible. And yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. Like, there was in that article or in another article, there was talking about like her wearing the white,
mm-hmm.
Like nightie,
right.
Which is basically like it looks like an old timey house dress, which
mm-hmm.
she's wearing, and the fact that like you can see her body through it is like of secondary consequence.
Yes.
So I didn't feel in watching this that. Any, the scenes are brutal. Like, there's
yeah.
no two ways about it. There's an incredible amount of nudity,
yeah.
which I was very surprised by,
mm-hmm.
but, like, none of it felt exploded or salacious. It
yeah.
felt like it was like, yeah, this is what happens. Like,
yeah.
the first thing that she does when she gets to the cabin, like, before all the terrible, is, like, strip down and go skinny dipping
yeah.
in the lake. And it's like, yeah, get it, girl. Like,
mm-hmm.
it's a nice day. You're at this, like, cabin. And it was just, like, here's a body.
Yeah.
Here's a body in the late 70s kind of thing. So it was just, like, yeah, if you're going to show a rape happen, it would almost be, like, a disservice to be, like, coy or
mm-hmm.
whatever with it. And then on the other hand, like, showing it too, like, too much, like, too sexually
mm-hmm.
in some ways, is the same disservice.
Yeah.
But with this, it's like, no, there is no doubt that these are terrible things that are happening
mm-hmm.
that you see and you're watching it and it's real and it's super hard to watch, but it wasn't like feel disgusting watching the extra ways that you were like, oh, this was like extra salacious or
yeah.
this was like extra,
yeah.
you know, everything.
It is interesting that like it's the nudity is framed as just sort of like bodies existing, whereas like
mm-hmm.
from the rapist point of view, when they sort of come back at her and were like, oh, you were dressed this way, you're behaving this way. I thought that it was just like really interesting because they're supposed to be, I don't know, they're just like mimicking back like all this sort of like rape culture bullshit, like
oh,
you're
yeah.
asking for it, but
yeah,
but they're not the good guys. They're not supposed to be, it's not supposed to be like, you're not supposed to be confused about who the villain is in this movie at all.
Yeah, they make it like very, very obvious, like
yeah.
the main guy, the head gas pumper guy or whoever
yeah.
he is, like, you know, the things that he says to her, like when he's exacting her revenge are horrible. Like, he's saying horrible, just like, sort of like dealing with that indignity again. But like, he's saying all of the things that like any woman has heard a thousand times through either being like said, like hearing them directly, or like the things that you're taught, like, you know, like, oh, you dressed for it. You asked for it. It was like, no, she got out of the car and she was wearing like a below the knee length dress and was talking about how she like wanted to stretch her legs. And he was like, oh, you were showing up your body to me. And it was like, yeah, because I have a body.
Yeah, she's like, actually just like existing in the world near them.
Yeah, she's existing in the world, and apparently that means that like he can do what he wants to her, which is like the whole rape idea.
Yeah. And I really appreciated the sort of like escalation of their harassment, because you're initially shown we're shown them gawking at her at the gas station, and then them sort of hollering at her, catcalling her from the boat as she's just like quietly reading, and she's like visibly annoyed, and then leaves and goes inside, and then sort of like sneaking around her house, and then the attack happens. Because rape and assault, that doesn't exist in a vacuum. It doesn't come out of nowhere. It's all sort of attached to this, you know, entitled patriarchal behavior. I just thought that was very cool for like 1978.
The escalation of how it happened, the progression and the escalation of how it happened was very like, oh yeah, this started this. It didn't, like you say, just happen in a vacuum. It was like they were kind of testing and pushing and like gaining confidence or whatever.
They probably thought they were flirting.
I mean? I mean, like, it's the weird thing where they were just like, oh, we're like, you know, just doing boy things.
Yeah.
Dudes being dudes.
Yeah, this is what men do. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was the escalation of it, I think, like, including that part, because there is some, in some of the stuff that I was reading, they were like, the whole, like, I guess, like, where you count the rape starting, like, if you, like, did it start from the first sort of egging and catcalling and everything, or was it, like, was it the physical act? Like, I've heard things, a little bit of criticism, saying that it took a long time, but I think that it was just, like, a natural progression of it, and it builds up, and then it gets to the actual acts of it, which is not just one, like, continues the trend of, like, growing, you know, getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah. I have another quote from a article from BloodyDisgusting.com by Mary Beth McAndrews. Through her eyes, the history of rape revenge films and the importance of female directors. So they write, the male gaze is prevalent in the rape revenge film to eroticize the survivor before, during, and after her assault, constantly subjecting her to the control of the male gaze. The rape revenge film, not unlike the slasher, is a film usually made by and for men. But unlike the slasher, the rape revenge film articulates feminist politics as a woman takes revenge against the men who rape her. These films do portray female power and some kind of reclamation of agency. So the author here sort of discusses how contemporary rape revenge film directed by women, such as Revenge, allow for more nuanced and powerful representation of gendered violence. And, I mean, I haven't seen Revenge, so I can't necessarily comment on it, but just how maybe like the difference in the gaze and how it's portrayed if something were to be directed by a woman rather than by a man.
Yeah, I am actually really interested to see Revenge because both of these quotes sort of, they totally speak to me, because this is how I feel. And the problem I have with these sorts of exploitation films, it's like big time male gaze. Like they've all, except for the ones that she was discussing, they've all been directed by men.
Mm-hmm.
And the part of the quote where she mentions the two unequal halves, I especially like, because yes, revenge is good, but not if it doesn't take up the same amount of space as the rape violation crime. Like you can't have like, you know, 60 minutes of this poor woman getting raped and in some capacity and then have like 20 minutes of her revenge, because then that's like horror porn basically. Like it's not like, what's the point? And it just feels sort of tokeny in a way, oh, she had her moment, and it's like, cool, like all the other things when
so
it comes
watch
to
like vicious attack
and female empowerment, like, you know, guys who say that they're feminists but only towards their mothers or like or like, you know, like we had a march, so things are equal. It's like, no, it doesn't count. That's not the same. Another issue that I have with rape revenge is like, just why? Like exploitation films have their place, but unlike hillbilly redneck films where people that are kidnapped by people who either don't exist in real life or who are like a giant combination of all the worst stereotypes. And then the people have terrible things done to them. Like, rape is a really common, terrible thing that happens. And I wonder why we need to exploit it in any way or, like, use it as the baseline for somebody to, quote-unquote, gain empowerment. Like, there's always something crazy about the woman who's been raped because she's driven to these extremes. And in their portrayal, she usually just gets called the B word or, like, terrible things were said to her. So it's like she had to endure this original thing and then to get her revenge, she has to endure these like new indignities right up until the end where she like, you know, murders somebody. Like maybe a rape revenge film could be a woman is raped and she tells people and like we believe her and the dude gets called out and she's totally surrounded by love and given all the supports that she needs.
Yeah, but that would be a like, drama.
That'd be full on fantasy.
Yeah, truly.
That would be a drama for sure.
Yeah.
But like I mean a lot of people could say, like, what's the point of, like, a lot of horror or whatever, but I think that horror is an important genre. But I also just, like, wonder about rape revenge narrative. Right. Like, I am interested to see a woman tackle it because, you know, that would be an interesting perspective, but also at the same time, like, why?
Yeah. like, just to go on your point that, like, I don't know, like, I agree that, like, what would be a filmmaker's intention, but, like, violence and murder happen in real life also. But horror, I feel like movies that portray violence and murder and horror still have this cultural value. And, I'm just wondering, like, do you find horror films cathartic at all, and do you find rape revenge films cathartic at all? Because that's kind of, like, this is, like, a fantasy to me. And at the end, like, when Jennifer's driving away from the murder that she... cause like she's smiling she does like smile a she's little smiling. Bit
I did feel so I mean like this is totally one of those things where it's never like it's a double-edged sword like for this I did feel like I think maybe because it was like 1978 and this film came out and it was like cool this is done we don't need to like keep making movies like this in like there's now like four I Spit on Your Grave
there's a lot
and like the original director did the third one and it's supposedly the only true one but it's like cool it's done, stop it like and she came back to star in it and everything it's just like it's like TV shows that keep going when they should have ended in like season three like it's good that this happened I think that it's good as a you know
there's like an important film sure
I think that this movie is an important movie because it is very uncomfortable and it talks about something and it showcases something that does happen and never gets talked about.
Yes, yeah.
And is so taboo.
Yeah.
And so, like, showcasing it in as real and brutal a way as it did is very important. I think it's important to talk about and to show things that are very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I also, like, what you do with that and why you do that is as important, if not more so, than just doing it.
Yes.
So, like, I think for something like this, it's like, yeah, cool. This exists. It's important. It's part of the canon of horror, or, you know, films. But, like, we don't need to keep making it because, like, what are we going to tell that's different?
Yeah. Like, what are you trying to say with all these sequels?
Yeah. Like, what is different about, you know, this, like, cool. So you get to have, like, 2010 revenges, which were pretty great. Like, TBH. But, like... I felt better after watching the 1978 one than I did about the 2010 one. Because in that one I didn't feel like she was given any real like agency as a character. And it was her revenge part was only 20 minutes in the whole movie.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of like an afterthought. Yeah. I mean the revenges were great, they were super gruesome. Which I was like, yes, but it felt like an afterthought.
Yeah.
But in the 1978 one, I was like, this is great. I feel like she has done all the things that she needs to do to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it showed her recovering a bit, and it mm-hmm. showed her writing,
yeah.
and then it showed her venturing.
Yeah. Yeah, so I really like, yeah, I really appreciate that showing her, like, again, just living and writing and working and, like, and healing on
yeah.
her own, and then killing
yeah.
some dudes. So, yeah, so that's our show this week. Thanks so much for listening. You can listen to Bikini Drive-In on CKW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg every Sunday at 4:30. And thank you, Sarah. Thanks so much for talking about this movie with me, this heavy, heavy movie.
Yeah, I mean, what better time to talk about rape revenge than when you aren't supposed to leave your house?
Yeah.
I'm glad I wouldn't watch the original, and it's been like bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah.
And one, so I'm glad it did. So thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's it. Okay. Bye.
Goodbye.